Okay, first of all, I apologize that this wasn't up earlier. The difference with 160 is that I haven't taught it before, so I don't have already an archive of recordings that I can go back to like I do in other courses. That and the fact that I have to put out about 100 small fires every day because of this COVID thing. But anyway, let's talk about the endocrine system, the next organ system. And we've already talked about the fact that the endocrine system, of course, is one of the body's two major control systems. The nervous system is the other, and we've already talked about that. Let's also remind ourselves that the difference, there's many differences, but a fundamental difference between the nervous system and the endocrine system is in the nature of the signals. The nervous system uses both electrochemical signals and chemical signals. Those electrochemical signals, remember, are action potentials, and the chemical signals are neurotransmitters. Whereas the endocrine system that we're going to today operates on chemical signals only. In other words, endocrine organs are not made up of excitable tissue like neurons are. So they don't create and transmit action potentials. But they release chemicals, and those chemicals are hormones. As far as hormones and neurotransmitters, both of which are chemical signals, are concerned, by the way, they can be actually exactly the same chemical. So there's no chemical distinction between a neurotransmitter and a hormone. What makes the difference is how they are released, where they're released from, basically, and where they travel to. We've discussed neurotransmitters already in both the muscular system and the nervous system. The neurotransmitters work locally because they are released by vesicles and travel just a very tiny distance over that synaptic cleft, and they operate on just the immediate cell that's on the other side of that synaptic cleft. They don't travel throughout the body, in other words. On the other hand, a hormone does. Hormones are broadcast throughout the body because they are released by glands and put into the bloodstream. The bloodstream reaches the entire body. So hormones are signals that reach all the cells effectively because all cells have a blood supply, or they're pretty close to a blood supply. The signals reach all the cells, but as we've talked about before, that does not mean all the cells of the body react to the signals, because in the case of all chemical signals, whether they're neurotransmitters or hormones, nothing happens. There is no effect unless that signal binds to a receptor. So in this opening slide, we see one way in which hormones can operate. Now, all hormones, like I just said, have to operate by binding to a receptor. But there's two major places those receptors can be, one of which is inside cells. That's what we're looking at here. Notice that the hormone is a steroid hormone. Steroids are lipids. All the steroid hormones are modified cholesterol molecules. They start out as cholesterol, and they get modified into any of the various steroid hormones. This is just one of them. It doesn't matter which one it is. It's a steroid hormone, though, and since it is a lipid, that makes it able to pass directly through the phospholipid bilayer of a cell, because the tails of those phospholipids are lipids, right? And they therefore don't mind being around other lipids, including any of the steroid hormones. So steroid hormones operate by slipping right through the membrane and enter a cell. In fact, they can go right through the nuclear membrane as well, the nuclear envelope, and enter the nucleus. They don't have to, but they can, and that's what you're seeing here. The point is that unlike non-steroid hormones, the steroid hormones enter the cell, and therefore the receptor that is the right shape to receive that particular hormone is located somewhere in the cell, either in the cytoplasm or in the nucleoplasm inside the nucleus. Once you have the binding of the hormone to the receptor, that, as we've talked about before, is simply another example of a ligand binding to a protein. The receptors are proteins. They have the right shape, and as we've discussed, the general consequence of a ligand, some particle, binding to a protein is that the protein will change its shape. And the change in shape of that receptor protein is such that it causes something to happen that wouldn't happen if that change in shape did not occur. This is how signals cause, how chemical signals cause things to happen by changing the shape of receptor proteins. And so there's many ways this can happen specifically with steroid hormones, but in a lot of cases, the specific consequence of that binding of the hormone to a receptor is that a certain gene within the DNA will get activated, turned on, and transcribed. That creates mRNA, which is an instruction for how to build a protein, which goes out of the cell and meets up with a ribosome, which are these red things that will instruct that ribosome how to build a protein one amino acid at a time. And therefore, that protein now exists. It wouldn't have existed in the cell without turning that gene on. That's direct gene activation, which is usually what happens when steroid hormones are the hormones. But the majority of hormones are not steroids. The majority of hormones are not lipids. They're amino acid based. They can be either proteins or oligopeptides. There are some number of amino acids big. Whether they're big or small isn't the point here. The point is that amino acid based hormones are not able to get through the phospholipid bilayer of the membrane. In other words, they are not able to enter the cell. Now, they're still chemical signals, so they won't have any effect unless they can bind to a receptor. But since amino acid-based hormones can't enter the cell, that means the receptors can't be located inside the cell. Otherwise, the hormone would never get to the receptor. So the receptors for the majority of hormones, the amino acid-based hormones, are located on the cell surface. They are proteins like all receptors, but those proteins are embedded in the membrane. They are membrane-bound proteins, just like this purple one here. And so this amino acid-based hormone, whatever it is, represented by the blue triangle, will be able to bind to its receptor because it doesn't have to enter the cell to do that. Still, though, it's a ligand binding to a receptor, and that causes a shape change. The point here is that instead of entering the cell, the signals cause things to happen inside the cell, not by entering, but by knocking on the door, basically. And the shape change in the receptor is such that it will activate what is called a second messenger system. The first messenger is the hormone itself, but its job is really done when it binds to a receptor. The shape change in that receptor protein is not the ultimate goal, but the hormone's job is done at that point. The shape change that causes, though, activates some other kind of protein, like an enzyme here. And that will cause some other signal to be created inside the cell, like this cyclic AMP molecule. That's just one example. It's a common second messenger. But the point is that a second messenger is really now carrying the message that the hormone was first carrying. The hormone's job is done, and the second messenger then picking up a note from someone who can only carry it so far a distance, and then that note gets delivered to someone else. And there can be more than one second messenger, actually. Several things can happen, but eventually there is some effect on cellular function that would not have occurred if it weren't for the original hormone binding to this exteriorly placed receptor on the cell surface. That's how most hormones work. Now let's take a little bit, look at a little bit of anatomy. This is a close-up view of a really important part of the two control systems, really. This is a view of the hypothalamus, which of course is part of the brain. It's called the hypothalamus because it's right below the thalamus that we talked about in the nervous system. That's part of the brain officially, so obviously that's part of the nervous system. And the pituitary gland, well, what we call the pituitary gland is really only partly a gland. It's really two organs in one. There is an anterior part, which on this is the left-hand side. So this is toward the left of the screen is toward the front of the body. That's the only part that's truly a gland. And then there is what's called the posterior pituitary, behind it, of course, which is not actually a gland. That's actually really an extension of the brain. The overall two-part thing, though, is the pituitary, which is one of its names, and that's what most people call it. It can also, by the way, be called the hypophysis. Not hypothesis with a T, hypophysis, H-Y-P-O-P-H-Y-S-I-S. And so these two parts can be, each of them can go by either of two names. The anterior part can be called the anterior pituitary, the posterior part can be called the posterior pituitary. But since this anterior part is glandular, and since the overall pituitary is called the hypophysis, another name for the anterior pituitary is the adenohypophysis, because A-D-E-N-O means gland. And the posterior pituitary can also be called the neurohypophysis, because it's made up of neurons, it's not glandular. The pituitary, though, is a kind of a master gland because it controls so many other glands that are important parts also of the endocrine system. But I mentioned earlier that this is really a meeting place between the two control systems. The hypothalamus is part of the brain, and the pituitary is part of the endocrine system, and they meet here, and they overlap in function, really. When we've talked earlier about the two control systems, I already mentioned that not only do each of the two control systems control the other organ systems in the body, the other nine organ systems, the two control systems also control each other. And this is a major way in which they interact. So the kinds of hormones that are released from the adenohypophysis or anterior pituitary are classified as releasing or inhibiting hormones. And that's because the effect of these hormones is either to cause other glands to release their hormones, or it inhibits other glands from releasing those hormones. So the hormones from the anterior pituitary do not actually directly cause the ultimate effects. They cause other glands to be controlled, and therefore whatever effect those hormones have, is controlled. The neurohypophysis, or the posterior pituitary, produces a much smaller number of hormones, only two, and those hormones are actually released directly from axon terminals. So this is not a glandular part of the pituitary, it's really just the ends, a collection of the ends of the axons of neurons that start out up here in the hypothalamus. And as we already talked about in previous chapters, the axon terminals release neurotransmitters. Well, in this case, these axon terminals that make up the posterior pituitary are releasing chemicals that aren't called neurotransmitters, even though they're released from neurons. They're called neurohormones because when they get released from the axon terminals, they get released into the bloodstream instead of just into a synaptic cleft. Okay, so let's go on to slide 4 and look at a picture of the thyroid. What we have here is the thyroid gland, which is a major gland in the endocrine system. And what's different about this, notice that, at the top is labeled as humoral stimulus, just like A was in slide 3 before it. Humoral stimulus refers to involving the bloodstream. And so, in the case of the thyroid gland, we're looking at the rear view of this, by the way. So this concavity right here is really where the thyroid cartilage of the trachea would be, or of the larynx, I should say. The thyroid gland is wrapped around the front of that. And so we remove that so you can see a rear view of it. But the thyroid gland is really not what we care about in this. It's just shown because embedded, usually four of them, embedded in the thyroid gland at the rear are glands that are called parathyroid glands. Parathyroid meaning by the thyroid. Not every person has exactly four of these, but usually it's four. And they're much smaller than the thyroid gland, but they're embedded in the body of the thyroid. The parathyroid glands are really important, despite them being small structures, because of what they do. They release what's called parathyroid hormone, PTH, and that is important in controlling the amount of calcium in the blood. Now, calcium is very, very important as a signal itself. We've already talked about this in the muscular system, for example. Remember that the muscular contraction relies on calcium as a signal. That's what allows, by binding to troponin, it allows for tropomyosin and myosin to interact and cause muscular contraction. Well, that's true not only for skeletal muscles, that's true also for cardiac muscles. So you can't have a beating heart without calcium, so that's an important enough reason. But it's also an important signal molecule for a bunch of other cells as well. And so we would quickly die without calcium ion concentration being properly controlled. And that's the job of parathyroid hormone, secreted by these tiny parathyroid glands, named for the fact that they are embedded in the thyroid gland, but they really have nothing to do with the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland has an entirely different function. Now, slide 5, that's a different kind of stimulus. Here we have neural stimulus. In other words, stimulus involving neurons rather than involving the bloodstream. And this little cutaway of the spinal cord, which is of course part of the central nervous system, shows you a neuron that's involved. The adrenal gland is the gland shown on the bottom. There are two of them, but this is just one of the adrenal glands. It is being innervated or connected to by a neuron coming from the spinal cord. And so the neuron, of course, will release what we would normally call neurotransmitters, just like for the neuromuscular junction. But here, the signals released by this neuron, these signal molecules, are released onto cells that make up the adrenal medulla. And remember, we've talked about these two words before, cortex and medulla. Well, the adrenal glands are another example of organs that have a cortex superficially that is different from the deeper part, which is the medulla. So the part of the adrenal glands that is innervated by the central nervous system is the adrenal medulla. And that causes those cells in the adrenal medulla to release epinephrine and norepinephrine primarily, which are stress hormones that we'll talk a little bit more about later. That's entirely different stuff, chemical signals, compared to the chemical signals that are released by the adrenal cortex. So it's really, the adrenal gland is really two different organs in one. They just are structurally packaged together. Now, the overall view of the body shown in slide 6 is showing you not all of the endocrine glands. There are many endocrine glands involving tissue spread out over many systems, actually. They're not all officially members of the endocrine system, but these are major and large glands. The pineal body is named for the fact that it's cone-shaped, like a pine cone, and it is part of the brain. It's basically about the size of a pea, and it's responsible for releasing melatonin, which you probably have heard about. Melatonin is an important hormone in regulating what are called circadian rhythms, which are daily rhythms. And an important part of that is proper sleep-wake cycles. And this is why people who are third shifters sometimes take melatonin to help them sleep, since they are really up when they're during darkness when most people are sleeping. The hypothalamus we talked about is actually part of the brain, and you can see that it is connected to the pituitary that hangs down from it. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The thyroid gland is located in the neck. Thyroid, by the way, means shield or shield-like, shaped like a shield. But it's not really so much that the thyroid gland is shaped like a shield. It's really more shaped like a butterfly, as you see. The thyroid gland, though, is named for the fact that it is placed on a piece of cartilage called the thyroid cartilage that really is shaped like a shield. And the parathyroid glands we just talked about, you really don't see them from the front like this implies. They're viewed from the back. The thymus is in the mediastinum, which, remember, is the middle part of the thorax. And the thymus is interesting because it undergoes a huge change in size. In a newborn, it takes up a big area in the chest, and it gets smaller and smaller as we age. And in older people, it's so small it can be hard to find, even. The reason that it has to be bigger in babies is that it's important in the development of the person's immunity. There are two different, fundamentally different kinds of blood cells in the body. Red blood cells, which are by far most of the blood cells. Those are erythrocytes, or red blood cells. And then the second category is white blood cells, which itself is really several different types. There are different kinds of white blood cells. White blood cells are collectively called leukocytes, because leuko means white. But there's five major kinds of leukocytes, and one of those five major kinds is lymphocytes. Well, there are even multiple kinds of lymphocytes, including things you've probably heard of in the news called T cells or T lymphocytes. Well, that T stands for thymus. And even though all blood cells are created in bone marrow in the skeleton, the ones that are going to become T cells first go to the thymus to mature. And so the thymus releases chemicals that are important in the proper maturation of those T cells so that they can then be released from the thymus and do their job to surveil the body and help protect us from foreign invaders. Next down, you have the adrenal glands that we talked a little bit about in a moment ago. Let me talk about the name of this, though. The word renal, R-E-N-A-L, means of the kidneys. And notice where they are placed. The adrenal glands are adrenal, meaning on the kidneys. Ad means on. They have nothing to do with the kidneys, really. They're separate organs. They were just named for their placement on top of each kidney. So there are two adrenal glands, and we'll talk more about their specific hormones in a minute as well. Then we have the pancreas, which is an interesting organ because it's not only endocrine, it is also exocrine. So let me distinguish between those terms. An endocrine gland is one that releases its secretions into the bloodstream, and it is ductless. It does not have ducts. So the product of the, or the secretion, the secretory product of an endocrine gland is hormones, like we've been talking about, released into the bloodstream and released throughout the body, or broadcast throughout the body. An exocrine gland, on the other hand, is a gland that has a duct, and it releases its secretory product, whatever it is, through that duct onto some surface. For instance, the sweat glands that we studied in the skin are examples of exocrine glands. Their exocrine secretion in that case would be sweat itself, released from a duct onto the surface, which in that case would be the epidermis. But there are other kinds of exocrine glands as well, and the pancreas is made up of exocrine tissue and endocrine tissue. So the exocrine function of the pancreas really has nothing to do with the endocrine system. The pancreas is a member of the endocrine system, but it's also a member of the digestive system. And the exocrine secretions of the pancreas are digestive enzymes that get released through a duct into the lumen of the small intestine to help the contents of the small intestine get digested into smaller pieces. That's a digestive function. The endocrine tissue that also makes up part of the pancreas releases hormones. And there are two biggies that you probably already know about, which are insulin and glucagon, that we'll talk about a little bit later. Well, this is also true of the gonads. Gonads is a unisex term. The gonads are the primary sex organs. So it's not penis and vagina. Those are secondary sex organs. They really are just delivery devices. The primary sex organs in an animal are the things that make the gametes or the sex cells, either sperm or egg. And so a male will have testes, which is the plural of testis, by the way, T-E-S-T-E-S, and each testis is both an exocrine and an endocrine organ. The endocrine part of it releases hormones, as I said, for instance, testosterone. The exocrine secretion of the testis is the gamete itself, which are the sperm cells. So the same is true for the ovaries in a female, except she produces different hormones, estrogen and progesterone, and she also produces a different kind of gamete, an ovum or an egg instead of sperm. Now let's go back to this important junction between the nervous system and endocrine system. Now, the focus here, as you see, is on the posterior pituitary, which, as I said, is also called the neurohypophysis. The yellow things are individual neurons. Now, of course, there's a lot, hell of a lot more than four of them. They're just shown in giant detail here. But as we've seen in other cases of axons, they are long cells with a pretty large cell body, which is where the nucleus is, and then a long, slender axon that ends in an axon terminal. Well, in the case of the axons here, the cell bodies are up in the hypothalamus, so they are officially part of the brain, and then the axons extend down into the posterior pituitary or neurohypophysis. And since there's a bunch of these axons coming from different neurons all bundled together, this makes up what we call a tract, T-R-A-C-T. Now let me explain that word a little bit better. There are two related words, tract and nerve. A tract is a bundle of axons in the central nervous system, either the brain or the spinal cord. Here we're talking about the brain. A nerve is the same thing structurally. It's a bundle of axons, but it's a bundle of axons in the peripheral nervous system, which is why we call those things nerves. So anyway, since this is a tract, and since it connects the hypothalamus and the hypophysis, or the neurohypophysis, this individual tract gets a pretty long name. It's called the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. But this explains what I was saying before. This is not really a gland down here. the posterior pituitary. Really, it's just a collection of axon terminals for axons that start out up in the brain. And so those axon terminals are doing just what you would think they're doing. They are releasing vesicles of chemical signals. But unlike the synapses, like at a neuromuscular junction, these chemical signals are actually released into capillaries that are part of the bloodstream. So this is why these chemical signals are not classified as neurotransmitters, because they don't stay locally. They are classified as neurohormones, hormones that are released by neurons. And they are released into the bloodstream here, and therefore, once they're in the bloodstream, then they can travel throughout the body. And so, as you see on the bottom, there are only two hormones that are produced in this back part or posterior part of the pituitary, and those are ADH and oxytocin. ADH stands for antidiuretic hormone. Now, that gets its name because diuresis, D-I-U-R-E-S-I-S, means production of a high volume of dilute urine. So very much watery urine gets produced in diuresis. The opposite of that is antidiuresis. And so antidiuretic hormone is named for the fact that it causes the kidneys to switch from producing a lot of dilute urine to producing a very small amount of highly concentrated urine. And you do this to save water, because the water that's in urine came from the blood. If you can't spare that water, then you want to keep it in the blood. That's what antidiuretic hormone does. And that's why the target tissue of antidiuretic hormone is the kidneys. Oxytocin, on the other hand, is one that I mentioned before, and right at the beginning of the term when we were talking about feedback, I use it as an example of positive feedback, right? Well, oxytocin operates on the uterine muscles, the muscles of the uterus, in that positive feedback mechanism I was talking about for childbirth, where the head of the fetus stretches the uterus, and that causes nervous signals to be sent to the brain. Well, the brain responds by releasing oxytocin through these neurons of the neurohypothesis, or posterior pituitary, and the oxytocin gets released into the bloodstream, goes back to the uterus, tells the uterus to contract, and that squeezes the head farther down, which makes it stretch even more, and that's why it's positive feedback. An even stronger signal comes back to the brain, even more oxytocin gets released, and so on. Oxytocin, though, also is involved in the release of milk from the mammary glands. Now, this is different from the production of the milk. There's a different hormone that causes that. But the release of the milk, the ejection of the milk through the nipples, is under the control of oxytocin. So a baby nursing on a new mother by suckling the nipples will cause oxytocin to be released, and that ejects milk out of those nipples. Okay, let's go to 8 now, and notice that there are many more hormones that are released from the anterior pituitary or adenohypothesis than there are compared to the ones we just mentioned from the posterior pituitary. Well, these have nicknames that are basically abbreviations.
It's 930.
Of course, those are just shortenings of their real names. Growth hormone, GH, prolactin, PRL, follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, luteinizing hormone, LH, thyrotropic hormone, TH, which can also be called, by the way, thyroid stimulating hormone, and then adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. These do different things, and they act on different things. You see their target tissues here. But the point is that these targets are all themselves glands. Those are all endocrine glands in their own right. So you have one gland, the anterior pituitary, releasing hormones whose effect is to cause other glands to release different hormones which then travel throughout the body and cause something to happen. So this is one signal releasing another signal, and they're both hormones, but they're coming from different glands. And that's why we call the hormones that are secreted by the anterior pituitary either releasing hormones or inhibiting hormones. They're called releasing hormones if their effect is to cause their target gland to release its more of its hormone, and they're called inhibiting hormones if their effect is to tell their target tissue, their target gland, not to secrete its tissue. So they turn up or turn down the release of other hormones from other glands. Now, growth hormone, as the name implies, is important in overall growth, and its main targets are bones and muscles. That's important not only while a person is growing bigger, but it's important throughout life as well. It's really important during growth, though. Prolactin gets its name because it promotes lactation. Lactation is the production of milk, which is why the sugar in milk is called lactose. But anyway, this is different from oxytocin. Prolactin causes the mammary glands to create milk, and it's stored in the mammary glands. It's not released yet. Oxytocin, which comes from the posterior pituitary, like we were talking about, is what then tells the mammary glands to eject that milk through the nipples. Follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone are both classified as gonadotropins because they affect or act on the gonads. TROPIN, that tropin part of gonadotropin, really means to act on. And so the follicle-stimulating and luteinizing hormone are both produced by both sexes, both male and female, and they're called the same thing in both sexes, but they are named really for what they do in the female only. Follicle-stimulating hormone, as its name implies, stimulates the follicle. Well, the follicle is part of the ovary. A follicle becomes an egg if it gets chosen. And so that's what that's all about. And luteinizing hormone gets its name from the fact that as part of ovulation, something called a corpus luteum gets produced. And that's where the name comes from. Well, these two hormones are called that same thing in males, even though they don't produce follicles or corpus luteum. But they do different things in the testes compared to what they do in the ovary of females, even though they get the same name. Together, they are called gonadotropins because they are they act on the gonads themselves. And that's the same reason why thyrotropic hormone, which, as I said, can also be called thyroid-stimulating hormone, is called what it is. Thyrotropic means acting on the thyroid. So the thyroid gland is the target of thyrotropic hormone or thyroid-stimulating hormone. And similarly for adrenocorticotropic hormone. That seems like a complex name, and it is, but it makes sense. Tropic means acting on. And the specific part that it acts on is the adrenal cortex, which is the superficial part of the adrenal glands, not the part we looked at earlier. This is the adrenal cortex right here. So that's the target of this hormone, and therefore, since it acts on the adrenal cortex, it's called adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH. Now on to slide 9. This is an anterior view of the thyroid gland, and like I said, it's really more butterfly shape itself, even though thyroid means shield-like, but it's named really for this thyroid cartilage that it's wrapped around. And the thyroid cartilage itself, which is not a gland, it's cartilage, it's part of the airway, it really is shaped like a shield. That's why it was called the thyroid cartilage, and then the thyroid gland is named for its closeness to the thyroid cartilage. But the reason it looks like a butterfly is that it has two large parts that look like wings connected by a narrowing, and that's why this narrowing is called an isthmus. Isthmus is a geographical word. It's a narrow strip of land between two bodies of water. Well, that's just like that. So that's just the gross anatomy of the thyroid gland, how it looks. If we look at the histology of the thyroid gland, so we're looking at a slide under a microscope here, we can see that it's made up of many, many follicles, which are little sacs, basically. And the walls of those follicles are made up of what we call follicle cells or follicular cells. Whereas in between the walls of the follicles are different kinds of cells that are called parafollicular cells. Once again, para meaning next to, just like parathyroid glands. The parafollicular cells and the follicular cells do two different things. They release two different hormones. The follicles, which are, like I said, little sacs, are for storing thyroid hormone, and that's what is released by, produced by the follicle cells or follicular cells and released into the lumen or the hollow interior of these follicles. So the follicular cells produce thyroid hormone. The parafollicular cells, on the other hand, release a totally different hormone called calcitonin. And we'll take a look at that in a little bit, but that's the anatomy. Now, calcitonin in slide 11 is explained. Calcitonin gets its name from the fact that it is involved in calcium balance. So there are two different hormones involved in calcium balance. I already told you that parathyroid hormone is involved in calcium balance, and calcitonin is as well. But parathyroid hormone is much, much more important. Parathyroid, and they have opposite effects, by the way. Parathyroid hormone gets released from the parathyroid hormones, glands, when calcium ion level in the blood falls below normal. So that's what we have happening here. There's an imbalance, an error signal, in other words. And the error here is that the calcium level in the blood is too low. That tells the parathyroid hormones to release parathyroid hormone. And parathyroid hormone then, via the bloodstream, reaches osteoclasts. Remember what these are. We talked about blasts, sites, and clasts before. Well, osteoclasts are bone cells whose job it is to break down the extracellular matrix that bone is made out of, the hard stuff. That's called hydroxyapatite, remember. Well, that hydroxyapatite has a lot of calcium in it. And so when an osteoclast is told by parathyroid hormone to break down hydroxyapatite, that's so that the calcium that's in that bone can be released from that bone into the blood to bring the level back up to normal. And that keeps you from dying because of how important calcium is to the beating of your heart and to all kinds of other things as well. All right, so that's why parathyroid hormone is so very important. And when people get thyroidectomies, removal of the thyroid, they have to be careful to not remove the parathyroids if they can save them. If they can't, then that person will have to have medication for the rest of his life to make up for the loss of the parathyroid hormone. We cannot live without it. Calcitonin, on the other hand, opposes or antagonizes the effect of parathyroid hormone, but it's not as important. By opposing it, though, what it does is cause the calcium ion level in the blood to go down if it's too high to begin with, as we see here. So now the imbalance is in the other direction. If the calcium level is too high, then that tells the parafollicular cells in the thyroid gland to release calcitonin. And calcitonin, you can kind of think of this as something that tones down the calcium level. Calcitonin then tells the osteoblasts in the muscle, or in the skeleton, not the clasts, the blasts to do their job. Remember that the blast's job is to build the extracellular matrix. To do that requires calcium to make that hydroxyapatite. So it takes that calcium out of the blood to make more bone mineral, the hydroxyapatite, and the effect of that is to bring the calcium level in the blood back down to normal. Now on to 12. And what we're looking at here is a little slice, as you see in the inset, of the adrenal gland. And you can see part of the cortex, as you see here. That's the superficial part, as cortex implies. And then deep to that is the medulla. Well, they are really two different organs, functionally speaking. The medulla is doing its own job, and the cortex is doing its own job. Well, the cortex itself, as you see on the right side of the figure, has really three major areas, three layers, and those layers secrete different things. Now, all of the hormones that are secreted by the adrenal cortex are classified as adrenocortical hormones because they come from the adrenal cortex. But there are different adrenal cortical hormones depending on which layer in the cortex you're in. And so the outer layer, or the superficial layer of the adrenal cortex, is responsible for releasing hormones that are classified as mineralocorticoids. Corticoid is a word that means steroid released from the cortex of the medulla. I mean, not of the medulla, cortex of the adrenal glands. So that's what corticoid means. Mineralocorticoids are corticoids whose job it is to control mineral balance. So sodium and potassium balance is maintained by mineralocorticoids. Glucocorticoids are released from the layer of the adrenal cortex that's just deep to the outer layer. And the glucocorticoids get their name because they are corticoids, steroid hormones released from the cortex, but their job is to control glucose level in the blood, which is really, really important because glucose is, under normal circumstances, the only thing that the brain can use as fuel. Other parts of the body can use glucose as fuel and other things like fatty acids or amino acids as fuel, but the brain uses glucose only. And therefore, the glucocorticoids keep you alive as well. They keep the brain from dying, and therefore they keep you from dying. And then the deepest of this superficial layer, the deepest part of the cortex, is responsible for releasing sex hormones, which are also steroids. So all of these hormones, mineralocorticoids, glucocorticoids, and sex hormones, are steroid hormones, and therefore lipids. These are the ones, as I said in the beginning of the slideshow, that are able, wherever their target tissue is, since they're steroids, they're able to go right into the cell, and they reach their target, their receptors inside the cells. But they do different things because the receptors are in different kinds of cells and they respond in different ways to these things. The adrenal medulla, on the other hand, responds to the neurons that coming from the central nervous system that tell these things to secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine. Now, slide 13 is kind of a complicated flowchart, but I want to kind of explain. I don't want to go through every little bit of detail here, but this is actually pretty cool how this happens. Decreased blood volume or blood pressure. Now, when the blood volume goes down because you're dehydrated, for instance, you haven't drunk enough water, when that blood volume goes down, that means you're no longer exerting as much pressure. So they go hand in hand, blood volume and blood pressure. If it drops below normal, then the kidneys will sense this drop in blood pressure, and they will release something that is called renin. And renin has the effect of, it's really, renin is an enzyme, but it's acting as a signal in a sense, because renin, which gets its name because renal means of the kidneys, renin released by the kidneys is an is an enzyme that converts something into something else. Well, that something that it converts is a hormone that is, that, well, actually a pro-hormone that is called angiotensinogen. Renin converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 travels to the lungs, and an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, ACE, which you've probably heard in pharmaceutical ads as because they make ACE inhibitors. Well, that ACE, or angiotensin converting enzyme, then converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2, which is now the active form of this hormone. And angiotensin 2 has the effect of causing vasoconstriction in the vessels, which will increase the blood pressure back to normal. So it's a pretty complex effect involving, actually it involves the liver as well, even though the liver isn't shown here. The liver produces angiotensinogen. The kidney produces renin, which converts that angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 then is converted by an enzyme released by the lungs into angiotensin 2, and that causes the blood vessels to constrict and bring the pressure back up to normal. Pretty complex set of signaling, but it really illustrates well that it involves a cooperation of a lot of structures. And in this case, structures that are spread out over several different organ systems, right? The kidney's part of the urinary system, the liver's part of the digestive system, the lungs are part of the respiratory system, the vessels are part of the circulatory system. By the way, there's another thing shown here, atrial natriuretic peptide, ANP. Well, natri comes from natrium, which is another name for sodium. That's why sodium has the Na symbol. And uretic means in the urine. So natriuretic means producing urine that is high in sodium. Well, the atria are chambers of the heart, and some cells in the atria actually produce this peptide called atrial natriuretic peptide because it has the effect of telling the kidneys to release more sodium from the blood into the urine. That's why it's natriuresis, or it's a natriuretic effect. But this brings up the point I was talking about earlier, that these outermost or superficial-most cells of the adrenal cortex are responsible for releasing mineralocorticoids, because the effect of those corticoids is to adjust mineral levels, including sodium and potassium. Slide 14. This is all about stress, and stress evolved as a protective measure. Stress keeps us alive under emergency situations. For instance, you've probably heard of the fight or flight response. Well, in a stressful situation like being threatened, you need to be able to act quickly and act well. And the stress response allows us to do that under a short term. So that's the so-called fight or flight response, a short-term stress response. And that involves the adrenal medulla that we've been talking about a little bit before. I said that epinephrine and norepinephrine are the two stress hormones released by the adrenal medulla. By the way, the word epinephrine is a word that really means the same thing as adrenal. Remember that adrenal means on the kidney because that's where the adrenals are. Well, epinephrine also means on the kidney because the little structures inside the kidney are called nephrons. So nephric is a word that means of the kidney. And epi, like epidermis, means on. So epinephric and adrenal both really mean the same thing. And that's why there's two different names for this chemical. We call it epinephrine in the United States. That same exact chemical in the UK is called adrenaline. Now, some Americans also call it adrenaline, But adrenaline and epinephrine are exactly the same thing. Well, notice that adrenaline gets its name from the fact that it's from the adrenals, which are on the kidneys. Epinephrine also gets its name from the fact that it's released by something that is epinephric or on the kidneys. But these are short-term stress hormones, and the release of it, of either of them, is caused by neurons stimulating the adrenal medulla. And so you can see the various things that they do. They increase the heart rate, because if you are in a stressful situation being threatened, for instance, and you might need to run or fight, you're going to have to ramp up your heart rate to prepare for delivery of a lot more oxygen to your muscles that are going to be working a lot. And so it increases blood pressure. It also tells the liver to convert glycogen into glucose. And I think I talked a little bit about this important function of the liver before. When you eat a meal and you finally absorb the nutrients from that meal, a lot of those nutrients, no matter what you're eating, is glucose, because that's the main fuel that's in all foods. So your blood glucose level spikes. It goes above normal, and the liver responds by taking in that extra glucose and sticking those glucoses together to make a polymer called glycogen, storing it for later use. Well, that has the effect of bringing the glucose level back down to normal. In a stressful situation where you really need your brain to work well, and you also need to feed the rest of your body with fuel, which is glucose, that means you're going to be using a hell of a lot of glucose from the blood, and so the body prepares for a dip in the glucose level by telling the liver via epinephrine or adrenaline to undo what it did before, to take that glycogen that it made earlier and split it back down into individual glucose molecules, putting it back into the blood so your brain can remain alive and to provide fuel for your working muscles. But it also affects the respiratory system. Dilation of bronchioles allows for easier airflow, because you're going to need to breathe more to deliver more oxygen to the blood, which is being pumped at a greater rate by a faster beating heart. That's the short-term stress response, the so-called fight or flight. There's also more prolonged stress response and involving totally different signals, which are mainly the glucocorticoids, but to a lesser extent the mineralocorticoids that I already talked about a little bit. The glucocorticoids, though, I want to talk about here. They're coming from a totally different part of the adrenal glands, notice. Short-term response, epinephrine, was from the medulla. The glucocorticoids, as the name indicates, are coming from the adrenal cortex, and they are steroids. So this happens much more slowly, and it involves the bloodstream rather than the neurons. It's a humoral response rather than a neural response. But in response to stress, the hypothalamus releases hormones called releasing hormones that cause the release of hormones from the anterior pituitary, ones we talked about, but in this case specifically adrenocorticotropic hormone, which gets its name from the fact that it acts on the adrenal cortex. And so that's already two different signals. You have something up here from the hypothalamus called adrenocorticotropic releasing hormone that causes cells in the adrenal cortex to release adrenocorticotropic hormone, which travels through the bloodstream to the adrenal cortex, which then responds to that second signal by releasing a third hormone, the glucocorticoids. And those glucocorticoids then have the job of telling the rest of the body, other than the brain, hold off on using glucose because we need it for the brain. The brain will die without the glucose. The rest of the body, you can use other things like proteins and fats as your fuels. So use those things for your fuel, and that will spare or save the glucose for the brain. The problem with this whole scheme is that prolonged stress suppresses the immune system, That's just one of several problems of chronic stress or prolonged stress. In the short term, it keeps us alive. But we don't want stress to happen very often. And this is why we don't, you know, we kind of jokingly talk about stress in our lives. It has a profound health effect. You want to try to find ways to keep your stress levels low, because if it's prolonged, you're going to continue releasing these glucocorticoids, which will have the effect of suppressing your immunity and making you vulnerable to all kinds of bad things that can happen. It can also lead to cancer. Cancers of various sorts. Okay, now let's go to 15. This is just showing you where the pancreas is located. If you ever do a dissection of a mammal, or not even mammals, other animal types as well, you can always find the pancreas in the same place, which is in a hairpin loop of a tube that extends from the stomach. So the stomach is an organ in itself, and then the next organ that it connects to in the digestive system is the small intestine. Well, the small intestine has three parts to it, and the first part of that is called the duodenum or duodenum, named for the fact that it is 12 finger widths in length. Anyway, this duodenum makes a hairpin loop, and the hairpin loop is where you'll always find the pancreas. Makes sense that that's where it's located, not for the endocrine system, but for the digestive system. Remember I said earlier that the pancreas is an endocrine organ, but it's also a digestive organ. And it makes sense that it's located here because the exocrine secretion of the pancreas, which we call pancreatic juice, and has nothing, it's not a hormone, it's a mixture of enzymes, that stuff needs to be delivered through its duct directly into the small intestine, so that that's where the digestion that those digestive enzymes cause can happen. So this has really nothing to do with the endocrine system, but that's why you find the pancreas, which also has endocrine secretions. That's why you find it located there. If we look at the histology of the pancreas in slide 16, we can see that the endocrine cells, these are not the exocrine cells. Oh, no, I'm sorry, both of them are shown. Here you have exocrine cells, and notice that the exocrine cells are forming little circles around a duct. So the exocrine cells are the ones that are producing digestive enzymes. Those are not hormones at all. And so all of these little ducts will collect into bigger and bigger ducts until you have one big duct that delivers into the small intestine, like I was talking about. That's not endocrine function at all. Along with those exocrine cells, though, there are collections of cells that we call pancreatic islets. Now, islet means small island. And these pancreatic islets are called islets because they look like little islands surrounded by these other cells. The other cells that are like the ocean surrounding the islands are made up of the exocrine cells, producing not hormones, but the digestive enzymes. The pancreatic islets are the endocrine portions of the pancreas, and they produce two major different hormones, insulin and glucagon. So let's take a closer look at that in slide 17. So these are the exocrine glands. They are not really part of what we're talking about here, but they are, that's like the ocean surrounding the islet. This whole thing is one islet. And in that islet, there are a couple, there's more than two, but we'll talk about two major kinds of cells. Alpha cells, this is a Greek alpha, a Greek version of an A, and beta cells, a Greek version of a B. These alpha cells and beta cells are the endocrine cells that make up the pancreatic islets. So they produce hormones. But the alpha cells produce one hormone, which is glucagon, and the beta cells produce another hormone, which is called insulin. Now that name, insulin, I'm sure you've heard of insulin, but think about what that word means. Insulin is named for the island. Another name for island is insula, I-N-S-U-L-A, which is why when we insulate something, that really means we're cutting it off from everything, like an island. Well, that's how insulin got its name. It's made from cells that are part of this little island or insula called a pancreatic islet. Insulin and glucagon are not only produced by different kinds of cells, beta cells for insulin and alpha cells for glucagon, but those two pancreatic hormones are antagonistic. They have opposite effects. They both are important for the same thing, which is control of proper glucose levels in the blood, but they have opposite effects. Let's look at that here in slide 18. This is another homeostasis slide, just like the one for calcium, only now it's a blood glucose level that we're concerned with. Well, if you have not eaten for a long time, that means you're no longer taking new glucose into the blood from the food that you ate. But meanwhile, the brain and other parts of the body have been using the glucose from the blood, so it's slowly going down. And that's the stimulus here, a decrease in blood glucose after it's been a long time since eating. That's dangerous because, like I said, the brain absolutely requires glucose to remain alive. So that decrease in blood glucose level gets sensed directly by cells in the pancreas. And that too low a level of glucose specifically tells the alpha cells of the pancreatic islets to release glucagon. Glucagon then has the effect of traveling to the liver and telling cells of the liver, undo what you did earlier. Take the glycogen, which is really a bunch of glucoses stuck together, and break that apart into individual glucoses again and release those glucose into the bloodstream. That will bring it back up to the proper level, keeping you alive. All right, that's one direction of the error. The error here is that the glucose level is too low. Glucagon takes care of that. On the other hand, right after, well, not directly after a meal, but say an hour after a meal or some number of hours, where after you've digested and then absorbed those nutrients from the food, that means you're going to be dumping a bunch of glucose into the blood from the food, and therefore the level is going to go way too high. Well, once again, the cells of the pancreas sense this imbalance, only it's in the other direction. Now the level is too high for glucose, and the pancreas responds differently, oppositely. It's the pancreatic islet cells known as the beta cells, not the alpha cells, that respond to a high level, and they release insulin. And the insulin travels throughout the body, but it mainly works on the liver and skeletal muscles, mostly. The point is, it does not act on the brain, and that's an important thing I'll talk about in a second. But non-brain parts of the body, it has the effect of allowing these cells to take the blood glucose out of the blood and bring it into their own cellular selves. So cells of the body, other than the brain, can take in glucose, but they can't really do that without the help of insulin. And so insulin allows them to do that, and the effect is that that will bring the blood glucose level back down to normal. Now back to this, why this does not happen in the brain. You, I'm sure, know that diabetes is a condition in which there's either insufficient insulin made or insulin doesn't work because the cells don't respond to it. That's true for the rest of the body other than the brain. The brain does not require the help of insulin to get glucose into it. If it did, then diabetes would be instantaneously fatal because it would disallow the brain from having glucose, and that's the only thing it lives on. So the brain readily takes up glucose just on its own. It does not require insulin. But insulin tells the rest of the body, okay, you guys take in insulin as well, and that will bring it back down to normal so that everything is happy. So the effect of insulin is opposite the effect of glucagon. They're both released by the pancreas, but by different cells. Glucagon from the alpha cells, insulin from the beta cells. Okay, now the next few slides are really all one big table, and a lot of this is stuff we've already talked about, but let's quickly go through these major parts. The hypothalamus is really part of the brain, but it releases hormones into a tiny bit of this is talking about the posterior part. It releases hormones into the bloodstream at the posterior pituitary, and those are the oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone that we're seeing right here. We've already talked about those. Antidiuretic hormone is named for the fact that it antagonizes or turns down diuresis. In other words, it tells the kidneys not to be diuretic, and therefore, instead of producing a lot of very watery urine, it keeps that water in the blood, and it produces a very small amount of concentrated urine. The reason it's doing this is because you can't afford to lose that water, because blood pressure and blood volume have gone down. You want to save it for the blood. Oxytocin, we've already talked about, so I won't say anything more about that here. The anterior lobe is responsible for producing hormones that affect other glands in the endocrine gland. So growth hormone, prolactin, follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, thyroid-stimulating hormone, or adrenocorticotropic hormone, we've talked about as far as their names are concerned. By the way, notice that the book here uses the other name, thyroid-stimulating hormone. I mentioned that earlier. Also notice in the chemical class column that these are all amino acid-based, the ones on this page. Peptides are short sequences of amino acids. Proteins are longer sequences of amino acids. But the point is, these are all made of amino acids, and they therefore cannot enter a cell. They have to basically just knock on the door by binding to a receptor on the surface of the cell. 20 is a continuation of the table. Pineal gland, as I said, releases melatonin. That's responsible in light-dark cycles, which is part of your biological rhythms. Your body knows, even if you're locked in a vault somewhere, your body's going to know when it's dark and when it's light, because you have rhythms that are established by melatonin. Thyroid gland produces what we call thyroid hormone, but really thyroid hormone is better called the thyroid hormones, because there are two thyroid hormones, even though they are lumped together in what we call thyroid hormone. They are abbreviated as T4 and T3, but you can see they have other names. Thyroxin is the main one, T4. By the way, another name for thyroxin, which you don't have to remember, I'm just telling you this to explain why it's T4, is tetraiodothyronine. Tetra means four, and iodo means iodine. There are four iodines in tetraiodothyronine, or thyroxin. That's why it's called T4. And the other one, T3, has only three iodines in it, which is why it's called triiodothyronine. Well, they do really the same thing. That's why they're lumped together in what we call thyroid hormone. And notice that they are labeled as an amine, so they are also made out of the same stuff, basically, that the other ones are, except chemically, they are like lipids. They're not lipids, but they are hydrophobic like lipids are, which means, unlike all the other ones that are made out of amino acids, thyroid hormone is an exception. And it's like steroid hormones, meaning it can go right through the membranes and enter the cells. So that's how it operates. It has to be bound to a protein while it's in the blood, just to keep it in the bloodstream. But then when it's released by that protein, it can go through the cells that make up the wall of the vessels, and it can go right into the target cells and connect to a receptor inside the cells. Well, the main job of the thyroid hormones is to regulate basal metabolism, or metabolic rate, not just basal metabolism, metabolic rate, so it can ramp up your metabolism if it's increased. Calcitonin, on the other hand, remember, is released also by the thyroid gland, but it's a totally different hormone released by parafollicular cells rather than the follicular cells, and it does a totally different thing. It it tones down the calcium level in the blood. The parathyroid hormones, parathyroid glands, four of them in most people, are only named for the fact that they're on the thyroid. They really have nothing to do with the thyroid itself, but they release parathyroid hormone, which is truly, truly important in maintaining high enough blood calcium ions to keep your heart beating, among other things. The thymus is the one I mentioned that is huge in children and gets smaller and smaller as we mature, and that's because its job, as I said, is to tell the T cells, or the T lymphocytes, which are a special kind of white blood cell, to mature properly so that they do their job of protecting you as part of an important part of immunity. And then we have the adrenal gland. We've talked about the fact that there's the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla. Here's the medulla. Here's the cortex. They are stimulated differently. The adrenal medulla gets stimulated by the nerves, or the nervous system, whereas the adrenal cortex gets stimulated by hormones. The adrenal medulla releases short-term stress hormones, epinephrine and norepinephrine, which can also be called adrenaline and noradrenaline, and that's for short-term stress response, whereas the adrenal cortex releases three different kinds of things: sex hormones, which are androgens and estrogens from the deepest part of the cortex; mineralocorticoids from the shallowest or most superficial part of the cortex, those are responsible for sodium potassium level control; and glucocorticoids from the layer in between those two, which are steroids responsible for maintaining proper glucose in the blood, keeping your brain alive. The pancreas, remember, is both exocrine and endocrine, but the endocrine function involves these two major hormones, insulin and glucagon. Antagonistic in effect, insulin has the effect of reducing blood glucose level by telling the cells to take that glucose into themselves. Glucagon, released in the opposite situation when blood glucose is too low, tells the liver to release, to break glycogen down into glucose and release it into the blood. So these are both responsible for proper glucose levels. And then we have the gonads, whether testes or ovaries, they produce sex hormones. So notice there are sex hormones produced in two different places. There are sex hormones produced in the gonads, and there are also sex hormones produced in the adrenal cortex. So, for instance, a female does not, of course, have testes, but that does not mean she doesn't produce any testosterone. She doesn't produce nearly as much testosterone as a male, because most of the testosterone in a male is produced by the testes, but she still produces testosterone because she gets some from the layer in the adrenal cortex that produces sex hormones. That's true of a male as well. It's just that in a male, the vast majority of his testosterone comes from his testes. A female produces estrogens and progesterone. By the way, these names also make sense. Androgens make sense too. That's just a general word for male or masculizing hormones, because andro means man or male. Estrogen gets its name because it generates or causes estrus. Estrus is a word that really means wild desire, what we would call heat in pets. That's why estrogen got its name. And progesterone gets its name because it promotes gestation or pregnancy. So progesterone is the hormone that causes a female to remain pregnant, in other words, to keep from spontaneously aborting the embryo. That's going to do it for this chapter.